Throughout the 1980s and 90s, Nazi fugitives continued to die off in South America. Although they were actively hunted by both European governments, the Israelis, and interested private citizens, only one prominent Nazi war criminal was dragged back to Europe to face justice for his extensive crimes. The rest found protection and shelter under the umbrella of dictatorships, or continued to move around regularly, thus throwing their pursuers off their scent on several occasions. Franz Stangl's former partner in mass murder, SS-Oberscharführer Gustav Wagner, the former staff sergeant and second-in-command of the Sobibor camp in Poland, had escaped from Europe with his old commanding officer just after the war, after their journey had been made possible by Vatican officials. On the 12th of April 1950, Wagner had become a permanent resident of Brazil under the name Gunther Mendel. Whereas his old boss, Stangl, had been arrested by the Brazilian police in 1970 and extradited to West Germany, tried and imprisoned, Wagner led a more charmed existence. Wagner remained at large in Brazil for most of the 1970s, but on the 30th of May 1978, he too was arrested by the police. Extradition requests had been lodged with the Brazilian authorities from the governments of Israel, Austria and Poland, but these had been rejected. On the 22nd of June 1979, an extradition request from West Germany was also rejected. Wagner was fully aware of all these legal machinations against him, and he endeavoured to remain one step ahead of the law. In October 1980, Gustav Wagner was found dead in an apartment in Sao Paulo, having been killed by a knife wound to his chest. His lawyer claimed that Wagner had committed suicide, though murder has not been discounted in this case. After all, it appeared to many of the interested parties that Wagner could count on Brazilian judicial indifference to protect him from extradition. And it would not have been the first occasion when Nazi fugitives had been murdered. The Israelis had done so on at least one occasion, when they had ordered the Mossad to carry out the murder of Herbert Kukurs, a Latvian national hero and member of the Einsatzgruppen, who had personally slaughtered women and young children during operations by the dreaded Arash Commando in 1941. Kukurs was killed by Israeli agents in Uruguay in 1965. Another prominent Nazi fugitive who successfully avoided capture after escaping down a ratline was SS-Standartenführer Walter Rauff. During the 1970s and 80s, Rauff was considered the most senior Nazi war criminal that remained at liberty. An SS colonel, his Nazi career had involved him in some of the worst crimes of the Second World War. Rauff had been an aide to Himmler's deputy, Reinhard Heydrich, from 1938 until the latter's assassination in 1942, firstly as an officer, the Sicherheitsdienst, the SD, the much-feared SS security police. In this capacity, Rauff had commanded the SD in occupied Norway in 1940. During 1941-42, Rauff had become an integral part of the planning for the final solution, developing gas vans that were used to murder hundreds of thousands of Jews in the Soviet Union. In 1972, Rauff was questioned by a journalist about his involvement in the creation of the gas vans, and whether he had had any doubts about their introduction to replace the mass shootings that were being conducted by the Einsatzkommando units. "I cannot say," said Rauff in Santiago de Chile. "The main issue for me at the time was that the shootings were a considerable burden for the men who were in charge thereof, and that this burden was taken off them through the use of gas vans." In 1942-43, Rauff was responsible for the murder of over 2,500 Jews in Tunisia when his unit exported the final solution to North Africa in the wake of Erwin Rommel's defeat of the British at Tobruk in June 1942. By 1943, Rauff was in Milan, where he commanded all Gestapo and SD operations in northwest Italy. He was captured in May 1945, along with many other SS officers, at the Hotel Regina in Milan by British troops, who had had to break through an enraged lynch mob to free the German officers who had barricaded themselves inside the building. Rauf was sent to an internment camp in Rimini. He was identified by pro-Nazi Bishop Alois Hudal as a special case, and after escaping from the camp, he was spirited to Genoa via several Catholic convents and furnished with a set of false papers. In 1948, Rauf was in Damascus, capital of Syria, where he was recruited by Syrian intelligence and became a military advisor to President Hosni Zaim. The following year, there was a coup in Syria, and Rauf was lucky to escape with his life, as those close to the old regime were murdered. Rauf fled across the border into the Lebanon, and from there to Italy, where using his false passport, he gained a transit pass for Ecuador in South America. Incredibly, Rauf was assisted by the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence organization, who had been using him as a double agent to help them penetrate Arab countries. The Israelis, like the Americans, often had no qualms about using former Nazis when the political situation suited them. In 1958, Rauf next popped up in Chile, where he worked as the manager of a king crab cannery in Punta Arenas, in the far south of the country. The West German government knew where Rauf was, and they issued a request to the Chilean government to extradite him back to Europe to stand trial for his war crimes. In December 1962, Rauf was arrested by the police in Chile, and it looked as though he would be spending the rest of his life behind bars in a West German prison. But whilst he was being held in detention in Chile in 1963, the country's Supreme Court decided to reject the extradition request, and Rauf was once again a free man. The West German government put pressure on President Salvador Allende, but he refused to reverse the court's ruling. In fact, once General Augusto Pinochet had taken control of Chile, Rauf moved back to the center of power and served as an advisor to Chilean intelligence. Pinochet resisted all attempts made by the West German government to have Rauf extradited, the last occasion in 1983. On the 14th of May 1984, Walter Rauf died of lung cancer in a private hospital in Santiago, an unrepentant Nazi to the end of his days. His funeral was a major neo-Nazi event in the city, and an unpleasant reminder of the assistance such countries had rendered to the world's most wanted men. One very well-publicized Nazi fugitive case that had a more satisfactory ending was that of former SS Hauptsturmführer Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, who was successfully captured and placed on trial for his crimes. Barbie's case graphically demonstrated how a wanted war criminal had been aided by the Americans to escape from justice down a ratline. Barbie was an SD officer and had been the head of anti-resistance operations in France. He had also ordered raids on French Jews and had overseen the deportations of thousands to the camps, including most notoriously the deportation of 4 dozen young French orphans who were sent from the town of Izio to Auschwitz. Barbie remained in hiding after the war until April 1947. It has been revealed that Barbie was an agent of the US Army's 66th Detachment Counterintelligence Corps, one of hundreds of former Gestapo and SD men used by the US in the early stages of their ideological war against the Soviet Union. Barbie proved an excellent asset for the Americans, and for years he ran a spy network of informants in both East and West Germany and in France. The Americans trusted him. However, in 1949, the French became aware of Barbie, and they immediately, and not unreasonably, demanded that he was handed over to them so that he could face trial for the crimes he had committed in occupied France. The Americans feared that if they handed Barbie over to the French, the fact that they had employed a wanted Nazi fugitive would have reflected badly on military intelligence, and Barbie was privy to many secrets that the Americans had no desire to share with the French. Instead, ignoring the demands of their ally, the Americans turned to the rat line run by the Croatian priest Father Draganovic. By placing Barbie on the rat line, the Americans effectively granted him immunity from prosecution in France for his wartime atrocities. In 1951, Barbie successfully arrived in Argentina with his wife and 2 young children in tow, and soon after he moved on to Bolivia, where he lived under the alias Klaus Altmann. In Bolivia, Barbie lived openly and associated with the country's ruling fascist dictatorship. Although he was positively identified as Klaus Barbie by French Nazi hunters Serge and Beta Klausfeld in 1971, the Bolivian government had no interest in extraditing him. In fact, in 1980, Barbie was part of the cocaine coup when Luis Garcia Meza Tejada seized power. Barbie worked for Bolivian intelligence, where he planned concentration camps to house political prisoners, and also formulated effective torture techniques based on his Gestapo experience in Lyon. Barbie also grew rich, managing an arms export company that diverted Belgian and Swiss weapons to Israel after the Jewish state found its arms imports embargoed following the Six-Day War. It was only another coup that led to Barbie's sudden downfall in Bolivia. On the 19th of January 1983, Barbie was arrested by the new government of President Hernán Siles Zuazo and extradited shortly afterwards to France. Barbie's return to France caused a sensation and a great deal of soul-searching as the nation came to terms with its complicated wartime record of resistance and collaboration. The reappearance of Barbie deeply embarrassed the United States, and the State Department was quick to issue a formal apology to France for delaying justice in Lyon for nearly 33 years. In 1984, Barbie was placed on trial in Lyon, but he remained an unrepentant Nazi. "There are no war crimes," he famously stated. "There are only acts of war." Regarding the French prosecution of him for war crimes, he said, "I did my duty. I have forgotten. If they have not forgotten, that is their business." On the 4th of July, he was found guilty of war crimes and sentenced to life imprisonment. Before he was taken down to begin his sentence, Barbie stated, "When I stand before the throne of God, I shall be judged innocent." 7 years later, in 1991, Barbie died in prison in Lyon from leukemia, some small measure of justice having been achieved for his victims. Some Nazi war criminals managed to remain in the countries of their birth, and through a combination of judicial indifference and misplaced humanitarianism, they avoided real punishment. The case of former SS Oberscharführer Karl Frenzel is an excellent example. He was the third in charge of the infamous Sobibor camp, working under the command of the later South American Nazi fugitive Gustav Wagner. Frenzel arrived at the camp on the 28th of August 1942, ready to implement Operation Reinhard. Appointed commandant of Camp No. 1, Frenzel held command responsibility for the deaths of 150,000 Jews. Frenzel also personally murdered at least 6 Jews, according to witness testimonies. In 1966, Frenzel was sentenced to life imprisonment for his crimes at a trial in West Germany to punish those responsible for the Sobibor deaths. After serving only 16 years in prison, Frenzel was released on a technicality in 1982, but he was rearrested and retried again shortly afterwards. Found guilty and sentenced once again to life imprisonment, the sentence was never imposed by the court due to Frenzel's supposed ill health, and he was given his freedom. This ill health did not prevent the Nazi from living another 14 years as a free man. Frenzel lived the last years of his long life in a pleasant retirement home in the town of Garbsen, outside of Hanover, where he passed away in 1996, aged 85. An even more recent case was that of former SS Standartenführer Dr. Martin Sandberger, who passed away in 2010 at the ripe old age of 98. His case demonstrated that it was not so much a case of what you know, but who you know. If ever family connections played a part in saving a Nazi from prison, it was this case. They say that it pays to have friends in high places, and Martin Sandberger had many such friends. Sandberger was the commander of Sonderkommando 1A of the Einsatzgruppen in the Baltic States. He was personally responsible for thousands of deaths, but in the end he was able to get off virtually scot-free because of his good connections among the West German ruling elite. Zandberger had had the good fortune to be born the son of a director of the giant German industrial concern IG Farben in 1911. A fervent Nazi since 1931, 5 years later Zandberger had enlisted in the SS. By 1938, he was a Sturmbannführer or major in the SS Security Police, the SD, as well as an assistant judge, a doctor of laws, and a government counsellor. In June 1941, Zandberger was appointed the chief of Sonderkommando 1A, part of Einsatzgruppen A, charged with following the so-called Führer order to the letter and liquidating all of the Jews that it encountered as the Germans rampaged through the Soviet Union. His unit entered Riga in Latvia in company with Sonderkommando 2 and set about destroying synagogues, murdered 400 Jews, and busily set up groups of anti-Semitic Latvians to conduct their own pogroms. In July 1941, Zandberger's unit moved on into Estonia, where his men executed by mass shootings a further 474 Jews and 684 communists, as well as large numbers of gypsies and mentally ill people. Zandberger personally sent a further 5,377 people to the concentration camps. On the 10th of September 1941, Zandberger promulgated a general order for the internment of the Jews, and his unit dispatched 450 to a concentration camp at Pskov in Russia, where they were all murdered. Zandberger's superiors were extremely pleased with his record in the Baltic states, and he was promoted to Standartenführer, or full colonel. On the 3rd of December 1941, Zandberger was appointed commander of the SD and security police in Estonia, returning to Germany in September 1943. In the autumn, Zandberger was sent south into Italy, where he became the Gestapo chief for the city of Verona, with responsibilities involving the arrest of Jews in northern Italy and the organization of their deportation to Auschwitz. Zandberger was extremely efficient and sent cattle trains east packed with men, women and children. In January 1944, Zandberger was appointed head of the SS Foreign Intelligence Service, Division A, part of the Reich Main Security Officers, Department 6. In this capacity, he was responsible directly to SS Gruppenführer Walter Schellenberg, Himmler's chief spy. Zandberger kept domestic, foreign and financial records of the organization and acted as a liaison with Himmler himself. After his capture by the British in 1945, Zandberger tried to use the secrets that he had learned while in intelligence to delay or even to avoid prosecution for war crimes. At first, this ruse was quite successful, the British, like the Americans, being more than receptive to former German intelligence operatives who were willing to reveal secrets and assist them in their fight against the Soviets. This strategy was successful until the full horrors of the activities of the Einsatzgruppen were revealed in the West, and it became politically embarrassing to keep such a prominent murderer as Zandberger out of the courtroom. At the Einsatzgruppen trials held in Nuremberg between 1947 and 1948, Zandberger was charged with crimes against humanity, war crimes, and membership of an illegal organization, the SS. Zandberger denied any responsibility for the murders that his unit had committed in the Baltic states, and he tried to shift the blame onto the German field police and unruly elements of the local Estonian Home Guard. This was rejected by the court. Zandberger also claimed to have arrested and transported the 450 Jews to Pskov concentration camp to protect them from the infamous Führer order, and that he had had no knowledge of their subsequent murder. In fact, Zandberger claimed that he was only responsible for a fraction of the killings attributed to him, at most between 300 and 350 persons. Despite the defendant's protestations from the witness stand, it is evident from the documentary evidence and his own testimony that he went along willingly with the execution of the Führer order, noted the court. Unsurprisingly, Martin Zandberger was found guilty on all counts, and he was sentenced to death by hanging in September 1947. However, Zandberger had no intention of keeping his appointment with the hangman, and the court had reckoned without the support of his powerful family. The death sentence was confirmed in 1949, but still Zandberger was not executed. In 1951, the sentence was suddenly commuted to life imprisonment by a clemency board acting under the direct authority of the US High Commissioner for Germany, John C. McCloy. McCloy had been placed under political pressure by Senator William Langer of North Dakota. Many of Langer's constituents were of German origin, and apparently many felt that the death sentence should only have been given to the most senior Nazi war criminals, and that handing down death sentences to the more junior leaders of the Holocaust was undemocratic and un-American. However, the real pressure that probably saved Zandberger from the noose was German in origin. Zandberger's father, a retired production director at IG Farben, a company that had deliberately built their Monowitz factory close to Auschwitz to benefit from slave labor, used his considerable influence with West German President Theodor Heuss to save his son from the punishment that he deserved. Heuss contacted U.S. Ambassador James B. Conant with a request for clemency, and who was going to refuse a request emanating from a president? Certainly not the United States, keen to keep the West Germans on their side in the Cold War against communism. If there was any doubt, Zandberger's father was able to drum up considerable support from among Germany's powerful governing elite, including letters from the Minister of Justice, Wolfgang Hausmann, and politician Martin Haug. Another supporter was renowned lawyer and vice president of the West German Parliament, Carlo Schmid, who went so far as to worry about Zandberger's prison conditions in Landsberg, and who spoke out in favour of commuting the sentence to life. By late 1957, Zandberger was one of only four war criminals who were still behind bars in West German prisons, a damning indictment of the official lack of interest expressed by the Germans in punishing the mass murderers who were living among them. Zandberger's powerful family friends ensured that this number was soon reduced to three convicts, when the West German courts ordered his release on the 9th of January 1958. Incredibly, a mass murderer, whose crimes had warranted the death penalty only a few years before, was set free to live out the rest of his life in wealth and comfort, in a cynical exercise in rehabilitation through family connections. Zandberger would live another 52 years, and when he died on the 30th of March 2010 in Stuttgart at the advanced age of 98, he was one of the last senior SS war criminals who had survived into the 21st century.